64. Impressive as it was, the brochure probably contained the seeds of its failure in an open letter from Graham, in which, despite his endorsement of the project, he said, "I am not an educator and have no intention of entering that field." Graham's decision not to play even a ceremonial role, however, seems to have doomed the project before it got off the ground. And the complete history of Crusade University is contained in a thin manila folder in the Billy Graham archives at Wheaton College, the institution it was expected to supersede. Graham repeatedly justified both his break with the fundamentalists and his decision not to take a more prophetic stance on race and other social issues by pointing out that God had not called him to theological disputation or headline-grabbing social action. His call, he insisted, was to do the work of an evangelist. And he ended the decade as he had begun it, with an intense flurry of preaching. During 1959 and 1960, he held rallies and crusades in 40 cities on four continents, speaking in person to more than 5 million people and adding 227,000 more inquirers to his carefully kept box score. The most memorable of these campaigns were a 1959 tour of Australia and New Zealand, which still ranks as one of the most successful of his entire ministry, and a less triumphant but still notable 1960 safari for souls in nine nations of Africa. Chapter 16. Unto the Uttermost Parts of the Earth. By 1959, Billy Graham was an internationally renowned figure, sought after by Protestant churchmen and civic leaders throughout the world. Still, the nations beneath the Southern Cross seemed a formidable challenge. Less than a third of Australians attended church with any regularity, and the stereotype of a hard-drinking, rough-and-ready, egalitarian, and largely secular people, happy pagans, they were sometimes called, seemed to fit a substantial segment of the population. Certainly the Australians had shown little enthusiasm for itinerant evangelists. They treated Billy Sunday and Amy Simple McPherson with virtual contempt. And in 1956, rowdy Melbourneites disrupted an Oral Roberts meeting with a stink bomb, then cut down his tent and tried to set fire to his equipment, causing him to cut short his campaign and return to Tulsa in humiliating defeat. Graham was aware of this history, but took some comfort from the fact that he was not coming as an unwelcome interloper. On the contrary, the impetus for the invitation, issued at the height of the New York Crusade in 1957, grew out of an initiative led by the Archbishop of Sydney, Primate of the Anglican Church in Australia, who was joined by most Anglican leaders and prominent churchmen from other Protestant bodies. When the Archbishop died in 1958, he was replaced by Hugh Gough, Bishop of Barking, a vigorous supporter of Graham's Haringey Crusade, who hoped for an Australian rerun of that great triumph. The Chief Justice of the State of Victoria headed the group offering a parallel invitation to Melbourne, suggesting a crusade would enjoy significant civil legitimation as well. When Jerry Bevan visited both cities a few months later, he found even broader support than anticipated. Still, Graham left nothing to chance. In 1958 to 1959, Bevan moved to Sydney, and Walter Smith, yet another Youth for Christ leader, who had joined the team, opened a crusade office in Melbourne. Both men set about to solidify organizational and financial support from the churches, to arrange for crusade sites, bus reservations, landline relays to more than 400 communities, and contracts for radio and television, and to launch the inevitable barrage of publicity. To build excitement, they scheduled screenings of several of Graham's films, including Souls in Conflict and Miracles in Manhattan, which told the fictionalized stories of several converts in the Haringey and New York Crusades. Attendance consistently outran expectations, and police occasionally had to be called to provide adequate crowd control. On the more explicitly spiritual side, Graham benefited from preparatory work by a team of teachers led by Edwin Orr, who toured churches much as he had done before the Los Angeles Crusade, trying to gather the kindling and stack the wood that Billy's torch might ignite a roaring blaze. Graham originally planned to spend 6 or 7 weeks in Australia, mostly in Sydney, with short visits to Melbourne and Brisbane. Sensing a real hunger for revival, however, Bevan persuaded him to plan major crusades for both Melbourne and Sydney, with shorter campaigns in the capitals of other Australian states and in 3 New Zealand cities. Associate evangelist Grady Wilson, Leighton Ford, and Englishman Joe Blinko, who joined the team after Haringey, would be the primary speakers in the smaller crusades, with Graham appearing for 2 or 3 climactic meetings at the end. This first use of associate crusades proved so successful that they became a permanent aspect of Graham's ministry. Despite all this preparation, the mission nearly had to be canceled. Shortly before they were to leave for Australia, Graham and Grady Wilson went out for one of their frequent rounds of golf. "I noticed that several times Billy would swing at the ball and just miss it completely," Grady recalled. He said, "It looks to me like the ground has ridges in it." I said, "You got to come up with a better one than that." I didn't take him seriously, but he insisted he was serious, and even got down on the green and felt it. Suddenly a stabbing pain assaulted his left eye, and he lost all peripheral vision in that eye. An ophthalmologist in Louisville sent him to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, where his condition was diagnosed as angiospastic edema of the macula, an abnormal swelling of the blood vessels brought on by muscle spasms in back of the retina and directly traceable to overwork and exhaustion. He might have suffered a bleeding ulcer or heart attack. Instead, he seemed in danger of losing his sight in at least one eye. His doctors gave him appropriate drugs, but insisted he take a long rest immediately and return to work only at a much reduced pace. According to Grady, they said it would be a whole lot better for him if I would just take a 2x4 and knock him in the head. They were about half serious about it, too. Fortunately, such an extreme measure was unnecessary. Through the generosity of a Canadian millionaire who had been converted in the Toronto Crusade, Billy was able to take his prescribed rest at a lovely estate in Hawaii, and to use the opportunity to prepare himself mentally and spiritually for the crusade. BGEA paid to have Wheaton's longtime president, V. Raymond Edmond, join the Grahams and the Wilsons in Hawaii for several weeks, just to teach us the scriptures. Grady remembered that for a couple of hours each morning, each of us would read from a different version of the Bible. Then Dr. Edmond would call on us to talk about it. That's the way he taught us the scriptures. That really refreshed Billy's heart for the Australia crusade. I can see now that God just set him aside for that month of time to sort of get his spiritual batteries recharged and all, to get him ready for the crusade. Graham's inability to cultivate the media and local church and civic leaders in customary fashion did not seem to hinder the crusade. As Jerry Bevan had discerned, Australian churches, many stimulated by Edwin Orr's diligent efforts, were ready for revival, and Billy Graham's straightforward simplicity was well suited to their temperament. In Melbourne, so many people had to be turned away from the 10,000-seat indoor arena during the first week that the crusade moved to an outdoor music bowl, where crowds of up to 70,000 blanketed a grassy hillside. Long scheduled events forced still another move, this time to the agricultural showgrounds located several miles from the center of the city and next to a malodorous slaughterhouse. At least in part because of a spell of heavy rains, attendance fell off, but still ranged between 10,000 and 28,000. At the final service on March 15, over 143,000 people jammed the stands and manicured turf of the magnificent Melbourne Cricket Grounds, obliterating by 27,000 previous highs recorded during soccer finals and the 1956 Olympics, and achieving a personal best for Graham as well. Normally, noisy trains rattle past the grounds. No serious problem for a cricket or soccer match, but potentially disruptive for a worship service. On this day, however, at the personal order of the chief officer of the State Railway Commission, the train slowed to an inobtrusive crawl as they passed. The railroad commissioner was not the only civil official to take note of the gathering. The Queen sent her personal representative. The governor of Victoria read the 23rd Psalm. and Graham read a letter of greeting and congratulations from his old friend Dwight Eisenhower. The response in Sydney and in the three largest cities of New Zealand, Auckland, Wellington, and Christchurch, was, if anything, even more remarkable than in Melbourne. An estimated 20% of New Zealanders attended the Associate Crusades and relay services. In Sydney, volunteers attempted to deliver an invitation at every home in the city, a technique that paid off handsomely. Total attendance for 4 weeks of meetings fell just short of 1 million, with 150,000 appearing for the closing rally at the Sydney Showgrounds and adjoining cricket club. To a degree that exceeded even Haringey, Billy Graham became a national figure. Observers doubted any visitor to Australia ever received as much space in the press. Certainly no religious event had been treated so favorably. Other media also raised public awareness of the crusade. Television had come to Australia only 2 years earlier, and Billy Graham was its first national attraction. The major network, Australian Broadcasting, aired numerous features and bulletins about Graham before and during the crusade. When Melbourne station GTV got a large positive response to a taped replay of a sermon, it broadcast others and found itself with a star on its lens. To encourage the crusade, and no doubt to build its audience, the station let the team use its studios as headquarters for the telephone counseling operation, and announcers encouraged viewers to call the number appearing on their screens. The first night, telephone calls mounted into the hundreds over the course of the evening. On the second night, an estimated 10,000 calls, many of them repeat tries by the same people, were attempted during the first hour, overloading Melbourne's automatic telephone network to such an extent that few people making any kind of call were able to obtain anything but a constant busy signal for several hours. On subsequent evenings, callers simply gave their numbers, which were then relayed to freshly recruited counselors who called them back as soon as possible, thus alleviating frustration on the part of seekers and keeping public resentment to a minimum. GTV also obliged Graham by letting him conduct a studio service one Saturday evening when trotting races crowded the crusade out of the agricultural showgrounds. The live program was viewed by an estimated 200,000 people. Stations in Sydney and New Zealand were not as directly involved, but they also continued to give Graham extensive attention so that he dominated television in both countries for nearly 3 months. It was, one Graham admirer said, the closest to national adulation of an overseas figure, other than the Queen, that Australia has ever seen. When the time came for summing up, the results were impressive. An Anglican bishop declared the crusade to be the biggest thing that ever happened in the church history of Australia, and the data seemed to support him. Total attendance for all services exceeded 3 million, and countless others heard the evangelist on television. Known inquirers numbered almost 150,000, three-quarters of whom claimed to be making first-time decisions. Reflecting defensiveness about stereotypes of evangelicals as unsophisticated people, crusade supporters proudly noted that the ranks of inquirers included the wife of a state governor, many students from top universities, scores of lawyers, dozens of doctors, more than 1,000 nurses, and over 800 high-ranking business executives. As always, distribution of the harvest was uneven. No church prospered more than Sydney St. Stephen's Presbyterian, which took in 310 new members during the first year after the crusade, compared to an annual average intake of less than 50. 2 years later, at least half of these remained active and enthusiastic. About one-fourth appeared to have fallen away. Reports from other quarters painted a familiar picture. When the pastor and members actively participated in crusade programs, some increase in membership was likely. Renewed vitality was almost inevitable. When participation was half-hearted or negligible, congregations experienced little or no growth, and tended to regard results such as those at St. Stephen's as freakish anomalies. Nearly all clergymen, however, registered appreciation for Graham's efforts, and many expressed gratitude at a new spirit of unity they had found in cooperating with clergy and laity from other denominations. Increases in church membership were not the only gains attributed to Graham's efforts. Charitable organizations reported a substantial growth in the number of volunteer workers. The Bible Society sold over $125,000 worth of Bibles, and managers of several bookstores reported that their entire stock of Scripture had been cleaned out. The magistrate of Sydney reported that some types of crime, specifically those associated with alcohol, such as assault, indecent behavior, and drunk and disorderly conduct, dropped by at least 50% during the crusade. The record on this score was not perfect, however. At a landline service in a church hall in Katoomba, 60 miles west of Sydney, a man listening to Graham preach about love went berserk, stabbing one woman to death and critically wounding two others. As at Haringey, perhaps the most important long-term result was the increase in the number of men inspired by Graham to enter the ministry. In general, Anglican churches experienced less revitalization immediately following the crusade than did other Protestant bodies. But Jack Dane, who later transferred from India to become a coadjutant bishop in Sydney, noted that 65 clergymen in that diocese alone traced their decision to enter the ministry to the 1959 campaign, and that fully half of the students in the diocesan seminary during the decade of the 1960s were there because of Graham's influence. In 1986, Dane asserted that today the Anglican Church in Sydney is totally evangelical. For all this, however, the 1959 meeting seemed also to prove that the days when an evangelist could truly make a dramatic and lasting impact on a secular culture were long past. As Edwin Orr, who became one of the evangelical Christianity's foremost historians of revivalism, ruefully observed in 1986, they were the greatest crusades Australia has ever seen. But Australia is still far from revived. From Australia, Graham flew to England, where he visited with the Queen and Prince Philip on Philip's 38th birthday. They talked, Graham reported, about the upsurge of spiritual feeling which is taking place here, and drank tea out of big cups. Really good. The Queen poured. It was just like having tea with any nice English family, he revealed. It was all rather wonderful. Unfortunately, the perfection of that visit was spoiled by walks through three London parks where he saw people openly smooching, and worse. I could hardly believe my eyes, he said. Once upon a time, people went to the parks to see the birds and feed the ducks. It looked as though your parks had been turned into bedrooms, with people lying all over the place in all sorts of conditions. In fact, Billy was not the only one to notice an increase of open sexual activity in the park. In the 3 months prior to his comments, London police had made 538 arrests for forbidden sexual behavior, but the deterrent effect of the crackdown seemed minimal. When a reporter asked Graham why he said nothing to couples he saw doing in public what is usually done in bedrooms, he replied, there were hundreds doing it. Overemphasis on sex, he warned yet again, would bring Western nations down. A few months earlier, he had offered the remarkable opinion that if the female bosom were completely covered, that would solve many problems in every realm of life. Now he lamented that the new generation coming along is far better acquainted with Jane Mansfield's statistics than with the Ten Commandments. From Las Vegas, where she was appearing at the Tropicana Hotel, Miss Mansfield replied, I can't help it if I'm on their minds. It's a free country, and I'm flattered that the youth of America is thinking about me. She noted that her figure had been given to her by God and by nature, and was therefore no cause for shame. And besides that, she revealed, she received more fan mail from 12-year-old boys than from members of the Army and Navy. A response she felt conclusively proved it was not her figure, but their liking for me as a person that accounted for her popularity. Mercifully, Graham did not enter into a continuing debate with Miss Mansfield. He made it clear, however, that he did not intend to tar all of England with the same brush he had used to depict the denizens of its public parks. Without citing specific evidence, he declared, I think the British people have a higher standard of morals than the entire Western world. Unsettling exposure to sex outside the home perhaps helped account for Graham's unexpectedly warm response to moral and spiritual conditions he found a few days later during a visit to Russia. Though he had been invited by the Moscow Baptist Church, the trip was officially billed as simply a tourist trip. When he attended the packed 3,500-seat church on Sunday morning, he and his associate sat inconspicuously in the balcony. Though church officials reserved a pew for him and provided an interpreter, he was not introduced to the assembly, and he took no part in the service. Someday, he reported, his fellow Baptists hoped to see a great stadium filled with people yearning to hear the gospel, but he anticipated no such occasion in the near future. The official said, we have to move step by step, and I feel this visit is an important step. He was not at all surprised to hear that atheism was declining and religion on the rise throughout the Soviet Union, since quite predictably he could read on the faces of the people a great spiritual hunger and some sort of insecurity that only God can solve. This deepening hunger for God that penetrates even behind the Iron Curtain, he noted, gives cause for hope and optimism. He was also impressed by what he took to be a high standard of personal morality among the Soviet people. In the Moscow parks, he reported, just a few days after his upsetting stroll in London, I saw thousands of young people, but I did not see a single couple locked in an embrace. I hate communism, but I love the Russian people and the moral purity I found among the Muscovites. This encomium to Soviet morality drew scornful fire from some quarters where he had been viewed as a champion. In New York, the director of the Anti-Communist Research Institute of America snorted, if by morality the Reverend Billy Graham means that the Russians wear longer bathing suits than we do, he's quite right. If his evidence has persuaded him that in the Soviet Union the entire culture places a lesser emphasis upon sex than is the case in the United States and the countries of Western Europe, that is also entirely true. These, however, are purposeless manifestations of morality when contrasted with the fact that those who first enslaved and then butchered the Hungarians, who were simply seeking freedom, were also Russians. Asked why he had not criticized the darker aspects of Soviet life, such as slave camps, Graham resorted to an easy disclaimer. I didn't criticize Russian slave camps because I didn't see them. I am aware they exist. He preferred to emphasize what he had seen. He took particular delight in the sight of the crosses on top of the Onion Dome churches inside the walls of the Kremlin itself, venturing that to have this religious spirit in the heart of the Kremlin is symbolic of some future date. And outside the Kremlin walls in Red Square, he paused to pray that if it be God's will, he might be present on that historic date. Back home a few weeks later, he recommended that President Eisenhower do his part for Russian revival by inviting Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev to church during his upcoming visit to Washington, noting that as a house guest, if he should refuse to go, it will put Khrushchev on the spot. Early in 1960, Graham embarked on an 8-week, 16-city tour of 11 African countries, adding a fifth continent to his career itinerary. This tour, chronicled in Safari for Souls, a Graham-sanctioned book by a South Carolina newspaper reporter and captured on film in a Worldwide Pictures documentary, was notable in that it aroused in Graham a keen awareness of the need and potential for an evangelical witness in Africa. At the same time, he seems to have sensed that he was not ideally suited to be the point man for any such attempt. Over the next 30 years, he would return to most of the sites where he conducted large crusades during the early years of his ministry. But with the exception of a 1973 crusade in South Africa, which he had refused to visit until guaranteed that all racial groups would be admitted and seated on a non-discriminatory basis, he never attempted another large-scale African tour. He accounted for this as largely a matter of circumstance. Other opportunities seemed more promising. Other groups exerted greater pressure. Africa lacked adequate television coverage, Quite likely, however, at least part of the reason he limited his efforts in Africa is that despite sizable and enthusiastic crowds in some areas, he and his team faced vehement opposition in other locales and at times seemed so out of place culturally that they could as easily have come from Pluto as from North Carolina. The tour began in Liberia, whose Christian heritage dated back to 1822, when freed slaves from the United States, with the aid of American colonization societies, founded it to serve as a home for other freedmen, in the hope of helping to solve the problem of American slavery. Graham's black associate, Howard Jones, who spent several months of each year in Liberia, and had a thriving radio ministry over that country's powerful Christian station, ELWA, helped organize the meetings. Graham could not have asked for more enthusiastic official cooperation. He came with a state invitation tendered by President William V.S. Tubman, who was also a Methodist minister. Baptist pastor William R. Tolbert, who doubled as the nation's vice president, served as crusade chairman. As a further sign of state approval, Billy was made a Grand Commander of the Human Order of African Redemption, Liberia's second highest civil honor. Despite support at the highest levels, the total attendance for 5 days of meetings in Liberia was less than 13,000. Graham preached to similarly unimpressive crowds in Ghana, where the Accra Evening News blasted him for his refusal to comment on plans by the French to conduct atomic bomb tests in the Sahara. Graham was warmly received when he called on President Kwame Nkrumah, whose own quasi-messianic aspirations had led him to erect a statue of himself emblazoned with the words, "Seek ye first the political kingdom, and all other things shall be added unto it," a blatant lifting of Jesus' classic directive in the Sermon on the Mount. "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." Matthew chapter 6, verse 33. In a reciprocal gesture of courtesy, the Worldwide Pictures documentary, Africa on the Bridge, offered a brief criticism of Nkrumah's this-worldly and decidedly leftist orientation, but was generally positive toward his achievements, noting especially the improved status of women in that country. From Ghana, Graham proceeded to Nigeria. He drew well in Lagos, 128,600 in 7 days, and enjoyed hospitable treatment there and in Ibadan and Uigo, but in Kaduna, Kano, and Jos, all in the Islam-dominated northern part of the country, he not only attracted modest crowds, but stirred strident criticism and resistance from Muslims, who, by his estimate, were winning 10 converts from tribal religions for everyone converted to Christianity. Here and elsewhere, Muslims appreciated Graham's emphatic insistence that he was an ordinary man with no supernatural powers, a stance that contrasted with the claims of tribal shamans, and fit with Islamic teachings about the non-divine status of all of God's spokesmen, including Muhammad himself. They disagreed, however, with his claims for the deity of Christ, and resented the straightforward criticism of Islam in his sermons. They were also disappointed when he declined a challenge to debate one of their scholars on theological doctrine or even to meet privately with Muslim leaders. On a more secular level, the strong endorsement he received from Christian political leaders led some Muslims to fear that he was trying to help boost a Christian government into power, a charge for which there was little evidence, though he did subsequently urge President Eisenhower to visit Nigeria to build better relations between the two nations, and perhaps even to use the occasion of Nigeria's becoming independent of England later that year to identify himself and the United States with the interests of African nationalism. Muslims in Sudan managed to rescind Graham's invitation to preach in that country, apparently because they feared he might disrupt proper observance of Ramadan, the sacred month during which Muslims severely restrict normal activities. The most explicit and memorable Muslim challenge, however, came in Kenya, where Maulana Sheikh Mubarak Ahmed, chief of the Ahmadiyya Muslim mission in East Africa, hurled a challenge reminiscent of that proposed by the Prophet Elijah in his famous contest on Mount Carmel with the priests of Baal. 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 20 through 40. In a letter to Graham, the Muslim leader proposed that 30 individuals, 10 Europeans, 10 Asians, and 10 Africans, all certified by the Director of Medical Services of Kenya, to be incurable by scientific medicine, be assigned by lot into two groups, and that he and Graham, together with a small band of associates, beseech God to heal the group assigned to them, to determine as to who is blessed with the Lord's grace and mercy, and upon whom his door remains closed. If Graham declined, Ahmed argued, it will be proved to the world that Islam is the only religion which is capable of establishing man's relationship with God. A group of American Pentecostals cabled him to accept the challenge. The God of Elijah still lives. But Graham neither picked up the gauntlet nor offered any comment to the press. Throughout much of Africa, Graham had to confront a force more deeply rooted and, for that reason, less familiar and harder to combat than Islam. The indigenous tribal beliefs and practices of animism, augury, juju, shamanism, and idolatry. In Liberia, at a tribal dancing exhibition, a little man clad in a country devil costume, a huge black mask attached to a kind of grass poncho that completely covered his body, repeatedly tapped Graham on the chest, muttering, "I am the devil, I am the devil, give me a dollar, give me $2. Billy lifted his arm and pointed to the man, exclaiming, "I've come to cast out the devil." Then, less dramatically, he knelt and grasped the man's hand in an attempt to make contact with the universal human component hidden beneath the fantastic costume. At Kisumu, Kenya, three men in full witch doctor regalia walked forward and took positions directly in front of the platform, standing stiffly and staring straight at Graham as if working a curse. Instead of calling for security personnel to remove them, Graham addressed them directly, announcing to them that God loves you and Jesus died on the cross for you. They did not respond, then or at the invitation, and Graham suffered no ill effects from their imprecations. No surprise, since they had been hired by a news photographer to dress up and help him obtain a colorful photo. Not every encounter left the evangelist so untouched. During a preaching stint in Kaduna, Nigeria, a Southern Baptist missionary invited Graham and his team to visit a leprosarium near that city. The missionary told Graham that Christians at the leprosarium knew who he was and had built a brush arbor of limbs and straw in the hope that he might pay them a visit and hold a brief service. To a man with such a strong preference for cleanliness and propriety, the sight of a village filled with people whose toes and fingers and noses and ears had been eaten away by leprosy must have been a horrifying sight. But Billy preached a passionate sermon assuring his audience that God loved them no matter what their physical appearance and that Christ had died to make it possible for them to have a new and perfect spiritual body in heaven. When he gave the invitation, dozens raised deformed and scarred hands to signify their desire to accept the salvation he proclaimed. As the team prepared to leave, a small woman with nothing more than stubs for hands approached him to say, with the missionary acting as interpreter, "Mr. Graham, before today we had never seen you, but since your London crusade in 1954, we Christians have been praying for you. Here in our little leprosarium, we have been keeping up with your ministry." Lifting an envelope toward him with her two nubbed arms, she said, "This is just a little love gift for you and your team for your worldwide ministry." Deeply moved, Billy grasped her nubs in his hands and thanked her. As she walked away, the missionary translated a note she had included. "Wherever you go from now on, we want you to know we've invested in some small way in your ministry and given, in a sense, our widow's mite. We send our love and prayers with you around the world." Inside the envelope were two Nigerian pound notes worth approximately $5.60 in American money at the time. Graham turned away to look across the vast brushland. After a few moments, he turned to Gradient Cliff, tears trickling down his face. "Boys," he said, "that's the secret of our ministry." To accommodate the low level of education in many quarters, as well as to try to overcome language barriers, Graham deliberately put the cookies on a lower shelf, using concrete sensory language and speaking in short repetitive sentences to facilitate translation. But he still worried that he was being misunderstood. On several occasions, the response to his invitation was so large and general that in an effort to winnow out those who were simply going along with the crowd or seeking to please the American visitor, he took pains to stress that becoming a Christian meant a complete repudiation of idols and other aspects of tribal religion. Even so, his efforts to bridge the chasm between cultures, though always transparently sincere, seemed at times more poignant than potent or prophetic. In one little village, where some of the women squalled and fled when he appeared in the midst of their huts, he preached a simple sermon and returned to his car, optimistically observing that just this little visit and somebody could be converted. Another time in Tanganyika, now Tanzania, he visited a Sekai village where a drunken dance was in progress. His white shirt, blonde hair, and open grin offering anemic contrast to the half-naked, painted, and festooned bodies writhing about in inebriated ecstasy. He did the only thing he knew to do in such a situation. He took out his New Testament and tried to tell one of the men how he might be saved from the chaos swirling about him. He might as well have been trying to sell the Watchtower in the middle of the Super Bowl. The hapless tribesman, more baffled than angry at the incongruous apparition, squatting beside him, kept saying, "I too drunk, I do not understand." Finally conceding that his message was falling on rocky ground, Graham consoled himself in the knowledge that he had tried, and politely stood back to watch as his camera crew documented the great gulf between depraved juju worshippers and the sober God-fearing folk who would see their film. Africans and others seeking to discredit Graham could easily seize upon his open and clearly stated opposition to communism, Islam, and tribal religion. They had less success in painting him as a white supremacist. Wherever he went, he emphasized, as he had in India, that Jesus was not a white man. People stumble, he observed, on returning to America because Christ is often presented as a European and thus associated with colonialism and imperialism. All over Africa, faces lit up as we told how Christ belongs to all races, that he was born near Africa, that he was taken to Africa for refuge, and that an African helped carry his cross. In Kenya and elsewhere, white and black Christians underwent counselor training sessions together and sat intermingled at the services. In northern and southern Rhodesia, known today as the independent nations Zambia and Zimbabwe, respectively, Graham insisted that blacks be admitted to services, making them the first integrated public meetings ever conducted in either country, and that his sermons be translated into the native tongues, not given only in English, as some of the Europeans on the sponsoring committees desired, hoping to discourage African attendance. He repeatedly reminded the mostly white crowds that the ground beneath the cross of Christ is level, and that all who stand there are equals. God doesn't look to see the color of your skin or how much money you have, he insisted. An impartial God looks on the heart. He does not look on the outside. It pleased him that many newspapers, including South African publications, duly reported that smartly dressed white women stood shoulder to shoulder with African servants. Further, the filmed account of the tour shown to American audiences during the controversial sit-ins that were forcing drastic changes in Southern society showed black workers in Rhodesian copper mines and observed that while African laborers appear content with wages and working conditions, there are increasing evidences of unrest, and many Africans include in their vision of tomorrow a dream of equal opportunity and an equal wage. Despite their officially integrated status, Graham's crowds in Rhodesia were overwhelmingly white, and most Rhodesians would never learn of his oblique criticisms of their society. Moreover, black African nationalists objected to his repeated insistence that only by sitting down together in a spirit of Christian love could any nation hope to solve its racial problems. In Kitwe, North Rhodesia, they swept through housing projects urging blacks not to attend his meetings, then followed up by heckling and tossing stones at the few who did show up. In nearby Chingola, where Grady Wilson was preaching, a more determined effort led to a clash between boycotters and police. breaking up the service and sending several people to the hospital for treatment of their wounds. His opposition to racial discrimination took sharper form in his explicit and well-publicized refusal to preach in South Africa after being told blacks would not be permitted to attend his meetings. To underline his position, he chose to follow a circuitous and time-consuming flight schedule rather than a much easier route that would have included a stop in South Africa, specifically because he feared their country's racial practices might embarrass Howard Jones. When 64 South African ministers chartered a plane to attend his crusade in Bulawayo, southern Rhodesia, he told reporters he was tempted to reconsider his boycott of South Africa, but pressed for what he regarded as inevitable changes in racial attitudes and policies. "I don't see how the South African approach can possibly work," he said. "Race barriers will ultimately have to end. I cannot presume to suggest a solution to the Rhodesia's or for the Union of South Africa problem, because we have our own problem in the States. Before I can preach about color in Africa, we must apply Christ in the United States." He continued to insist, however, that the key to any change in policy would have to be a change of heart of the sort that only true conversion to Christ was likely to bring. On his return to the United States later in the spring, he declined to comment on the lunch counter sit-ins and progress in the South on the grounds that he knew too little about them. But he said of the South African situation that to keep the races in total separation is a policy that won't work and is immoral and unchristian, adding pointedly that I would say the same of our past treatment of the Indians as we look back on it. The reference to Indians was a sign of still widening social conscience, not an attempt to finesse the current racial unrest among blacks. Graham explicitly warned that American failure to solve its own racial problems was a key factor in the appeal of communism to many Africans. "They doubt the United States will be a true friend," he explained. "Somehow Americans of both races are going to have to find an amicable solution, or we may lose the friendship of this richest continent on earth." The alternative to a peaceful solution, he feared, was too dreadful to contemplate. 70% of the world's population is colored, he pointed out. "They will exterminate the white race if we don't end discrimination." Once again, he asserted, the only way either America or South Africa could summon the insight and moral courage to institute these changes was through sweeping religious revival. "Only religion," he said, "can create an atmosphere in which all racial differences can be settled." The Soul Safari wound up with visits to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where he was received by the Patriarch of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church and Emperor Haile Selassie, a longtime friend of evangelical missions. After Ethiopia, Graham drew 10,000 people to a rally held under a giant crimson tent in Cairo, apparently the first such Christian meeting in Egyptian history. Arrangements for both visits had been smoothed by assistance from Vice President Nixon's office. Later, Graham revealed that he had been invited to hold a full-scale crusade in the Egyptian capital, but decided against it, explaining that such a crusade in the United Arab Republic would cause thousands and thousands of Christians to be publicly identified with a white Western American evangelist. "I would not want anyone to suffer needlessly for their loyalty to Christ, and most certainly never to be injured or abused by their appearance at one of our rallies." True to the vow he made to Jack Dane following his Indian tour, Graham largely avoided condescending assessments of African culture when he returned to the United States. He spoke of communism as erroneous and dangerous, and he lamented the fanatic devotion he found among Africa's Muslims. But he clearly regarded both ideologies as formidable forces. The film Africa on the Bridge referred to tribal idols that can neither see nor speak, and included the scenes of tribesmen having their faces scarred in religious ceremonies. But the narrator said without obvious condescension that beliefs that are to us foolishness are to millions of Africans the final word about God and the world about them. When portraying other aspects of African life, the documentary took a decidedly non-judgmental tack. Bare-breasted women were shown suckling their young or simply walking along the roadside, with no clucking judgments about their lack of modesty. In an amusing juxtaposition that must have caused consternation when it was shown in evangelical congregations that frowned on any public exposure of the body, including swimming in mixed groups, the film contained a sequence in which the world's most famous evangelist and his faithful sidekicks were shown lounging on the deck of a river launch clad in nothing but swimsuits. Perhaps reflecting Graham's own love of animals, recalling his boyhood fantasies of playing Tarzan in the woods behind the dairy barn, he relished telling of how he and Cliff Barrows had whooped with delight as the little plane in which they were riding flew over great herds of elephants, zebras, antelopes, and buffalo in Kenya. The film also included extended scenes of African wildlife, including one in which lions stalked and killed a water buck, and another in which members of the team delighted in the antics of a band of baboons. Similarly, scenes of tribal dances, which might have been lambasted as depraved pagan rituals, were presented as joyous occasions that proved the African has great talent for sheer showmanship. Implicit throughout, of course, was a recognition that Africa was in large measure still a backward continent. But this assumption took on a descriptive rather than evaluative tone. The primary message was that the continent had great potential, that it was poised promisingly, if somewhat precariously, on the bridge to full modernity, and that all it needed to lead it across was the enabling power of Christ. As a reprise to the African tour, Graham visited both Jordan and Israel, neither of which was overjoyed. Jordan, in fact, had banned him from entry, charging him with propaganda and fundraising activities on Israel's behalf. The evangelist acknowledged having friends in Israel, but denied he had raised money or assisted that country in any notable way. As a Christian, he said, "I'm both pro-Jew and pro-Arab." After an amusing exchange of disclaimers, a BGA spokesman said the Jordanian embassy in Washington recommended the ban. An embassy spokesman said he had never heard of Billy Graham and knew of no ban, and Graham said that as far as he knew, he had made no request to visit Jordan, but hoped he would be able to. A Muslim businessman in Charlotte contacted an influential relative in Jordan and managed to get the ban lifted. If resistance truly existed, it posed no obvious problem. King Hussein welcomed him for a brief visit, and in a singular gesture of ecumenical goodwill, a Muslim radio station recorded his sermon on John chapter 3, verse 16, replaying it several times while he was in the country. Israeli authorities gave Graham a warmer official welcome, but refused to let the sponsoring Christian Council rent large halls for public meetings. As a further restriction, in an off-the-record agreement that Time magazine got hold of, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion enjoined the evangelist from mentioning Jesus while speaking to Jewish audiences. Graham graciously indicated he would accept both limitations. At a press conference in the King David Hotel, he noted that one of his reasons for coming to Israel was to preach the gospel, then added, "But I want to make it clear that I'm going to address only Christian audiences. I have no intention of proselytizing. In fact, I must be grateful to you for proselytizing me. For Jesus Christ was a Jew. All the apostles were Jews, and the whole early church was Jewish." At the same gathering, he expressed his delight at being able to see the new nation, where the Star of David now flies again after 24 centuries. These generous gestures softened most of whatever resistance remained, so that some Israelis protested the restrictions on Graham, and when he preached an unapologetically evangelistic message to an audience that was ostensibly Christian, but which some observers guessed to be 70% Jewish, no complaint was raised. To avoid any unpleasantness, Graham offered no invitation, but suggested that any who wished to receive Christ should contact representatives of the Christian Council. While in the country, Graham visited with Israeli President Ben-Zvi and established friendships of long standing with Israeli political giants Abba Ibn and Golda Meir. A few years later, Mizmahir presented him with one of his most treasured possessions, a Bible inscribed to a great teacher in all the important matters to humanity and a true friend of Israel. He also visited with the head of the Ministry of Religion, Rabbi Toledano. When Graham inevitably affirmed his own belief that Jesus is the promised Messiah, the white-bearded rabbi softly observed, "When the messianic times come, then we will know the truth." The African tour capped slightly more than a decade of activity during which Billy Graham emerged from virtual anonymity outside evangelical circles to become one of the best-known and most widely admired men in the world. The Loose Clipping Service reported that it processed more than 5,000 articles about him each month, more than Franklin D. Roosevelt generated during his heyday. He was clearly the primary spokesman for evangelicalism and, in the eyes of many, for Protestant Christianity as a whole. According to some, his fame and the accompanying attention paid to religious revival played a significant role in increasing the amount of coverage given to religion in daily newspapers and stimulated Time and Newsweek to initiate a regular section devoted to religion. As he had risen from preaching to drunks and brawlers in saloons and stockades to addressing tens of thousands in Olympic stadia and storied arenas, and to sharing his faith quietly with kings and queens, presidents and prime ministers, captains of industry, and masters of mass media, he had led his people out of a cultural wilderness, had helped make them feel that America was once again one nation under God, and that they were among its finest citizens. From this pinnacle of accomplishment and renown, Graham could see all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. He had faced and fought bravely with powerful temptations, so that even his harshest critics acknowledged his genuineness. He lived well, but not nearly so well as he might have, and no hint of scandal tarnished his public or private image. He was clearly fascinated by fame, but his omnipresent fear of the very celebrity he sought kept the excesses of that particularly treacherous lust in harness, if not completely subdued. Fame and recognition had brought influence into power. He had made modest efforts to use them, with results that both encouraged and disquieted him. But the greatest opportunities, and with them the deepest pitfalls, still lay ahead. Part 4. The Kingdoms of the World and Their Glory, 1960 to 1974. Chapter 17. Election and Free Will. When Graham returned to America after his African tour, he gave a full report to President Eisenhower, Vice President Nixon, and Secretary of State Christian Herter, who assembled a handful of top aides for an informal briefing that lasted several hours, an indication that the White House regarded him not simply as a goodwill ambassador, but as a man whose contacts and observations might make him a valuable diplomatic resource. Eisenhower seemed to appreciate the contact and information, and Graham urged him to visit Nigeria at his earliest opportunity to help prevent that pivotal nation from falling into communist hands. This visit to the White House renewed Graham's sense of standing near the center of power and doubtless reinforced his desire to remain there, a prospect that was less than certain. The president would soon be stepping down. It seemed obvious Richard Nixon would be the Republican nominee, though it was no secret Eisenhower was less than enthusiastic about him, and the growing possibility that the attractive young senator from Massachusetts, John F. Kennedy, might get the Democratic nomination made it far from certain Nixon could win the election without a real struggle. Because he felt close to the vice president, and because he enjoyed a personal relationship he had little chance of duplicating with Kennedy, Graham began to explore ways in which he might help his friend hold on to power. Billy always found fewer faults in his friends than others managed to see. If they liked him, he liked them, and was inclined to think the best of them and regard patent shortcomings as little more than a failure to let the sterling character he was sure they possessed manifest itself with sufficient force. Nearly a decade of friendship with Nixon, nurtured by occasional games of golf, ritual exchanges of gifts and greetings, Graham's behind-the-scenes support of the Republican ticket in 1956, and Nixon's reciprocal appearance at the 1957 Yankee Stadium rally, had left Billy with remarkably few reservations about the vice president, and in private conversations he tried to allay Eisenhower's anxieties at the prospect of a Nixon presidency. Still, he sometimes wished his friend would make it easier for him to offer his wholehearted support. In 1959, he told Nixon, "If I have one suggestion for you, it is this. There are many, many reasons why I would strongly urge you to attend church regularly and faithfully from now on. I'm convinced that you are going to have the backing of the overwhelming majority of the religiously minded people in America. It would be most unfortunate if some of your political enemies could point to any inconsistency." He also noted that he had mentioned Nixon several times in his Hour of Decision broadcasts, and practically came out in full support of you a few weeks ago by saying that you were the best qualified and best trained man in America for the presidency. In May 1960, as Kennedy's prospects improved, Graham told a group of reporters that this is a time of world tension. "It is a time for a man of world stature. I don't think it's a time to experiment with novices." He added that while he intended to stay out of politics, he had deep personal convictions on the matter. When asked if his convictions stemmed from his friendship with Nixon, he replied with a smile, "Might be, but I'm not taking sides." According to one columnist's report, the 50 correspondents roared with laughter. 2 days later, Graham contacted the Nixon staff to say that after deep and long consideration, he was coming out publicly on the vice president's behalf. He also indicated, a Nixon aide reported, that he was going to be on Meet the Press sometime early in June, and that if we felt that was the time for him to do it, he would use that as the forum. Between them, Graham and Nixon apparently decided that something less than a flat-out endorsement would better serve the interests of both men, at least for the time being. As the campaigns heated up, Graham warmed to the task of giving advice, often on matters with a less than obvious connection to eternal salvation. After Eisenhower denied, then subsequently admitted, that the U-2 aircraft downed by the Russians was indeed a U.S. spy plane, Graham told Nixon, "In my opinion, the current U-2 incident is political dynamite. My advice, for what it's worth, would be to keep as quiet as possible." It is difficult to tell which way sentiment is going to turn. "I think the mood of the people at the moment is to resent this incident being used for political advantage by either party." He went on to offer his observations about possible communist attempts to influence the coming election, revealing continued respectful fear of the enemy's diabolical cleverness. "It's been my contention since the beginning," he volunteered, "that Mr. Khrushchev is interjecting himself into the American political campaign." Without suggesting how the Soviet leader might accomplish his aim, he said, "I believe he is hopeful that he can force one of the parties to nominate a man that he can get along with. After the nomination of such a man, the left-wingers and fellow travelers in this country will go all out to elect him. I'm more convinced than ever that you will be the next president of the United States." Although Graham had suggested earlier that if Kennedy were elected, the religious issue could work in Nixon's favor, he now saw another side to the situation. "If Senator Kennedy is nominated," he predicted, "he will capture the Catholic vote, almost 100%. No matter what concessions you make to the Catholic Church or how you play up to them, even if you had a Catholic running mate, you would not even crack 5 or 10% of the Catholic vote. Adding that Johnson, Smathers, Rayburn, and others agree with me at this point, he concluded, "Since the Protestant voters outnumber the Catholics 3-1, you must concentrate on solidifying the Protestant vote. In my opinion, if you make a mistake of having a Catholic running mate, you will divide the Protestants and make no inroads whatsoever in the Catholic vote. Therefore, I hope you will discard this idea at all costs. It is imperative for you to have as your running mate someone in the Protestant Church, someone the Protestant Church can rally behind enthusiastically. I can think of only one man in the Republican Party who has the support of both liberals and conservatives in the Protestant Church, and that is Dr. Walter Judd. a former evangelical missionary whom Graham greatly admired and who he undoubtedly hoped could bolster the efforts of new evangelicals to influence national policy. "They don't all agree with him," he conceded, "but they deeply respect him. Having been a missionary and being one of the ablest speakers in America, it is my opinion he would be almost a must. With Dr. Judd, I believe the two of you could present a picture to America that would put much of the South and border states